States.
Whose land is this?
Mohegan,
The point is that I think it is absolutely crucial for us to attend to whose land this is. At the same time, we need to not get lost in the urgent. We need to not lose the urgency of the fact that 120 species went extinct today, and the corporate culture is killing the planet. And I think that, remember, Maud Gunn was part of the English Gaelic revival, and she recognized the importance of reviving the Gaelic language for Irish resistance at the same time that she was smuggling stuff into prisons. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, I think that this little exercise is actually really important. At the same time, and fun, at the same time, I think that I want to thank you, not forgive you. I want to thank you for also returning us to the urgency. Do you see what I'm saying? That I think we desperately need it all, including attention to language, including... I just learned this yesterday, that there is... I'm not going to say who it is, but there is... And this is pretty disgusting. It's disgusting the fact I even know this. There is a sort of environmental leader, male, who is proud of the fact that when he... I think "fucks" would be the term, a woman that he likes to call her bitch and have her call him daddy. That's pretty problematical. And at the same, I mean, so, but we can hold in our hearts the understanding that that's really fucked up, at the same time that there's this other going on. Does that make sense? I'm trying to welcome and honor your sense of urgency, which you know from my work that I desperately share, at the same time that I honor the fact that it can be insulting for someone to call a woman's genitals. I think that though we can hold both of those. Okay, and actually I'm gonna give another example I think that is really, really important, which is two of Ward Churchill's ex-wives have accused him of being a batterer. And I think it's pretty safe to say that Ward Churchill is an abuser. And right now, there's a woman I know who's a great activist who doesn't want to be in a film because Ward Churchill is also in that film. And she doesn't want to be in a film with a batterer. And that's very true, and I respect that. At the same time, how many people are calling for the militant resistance against this culture and for us to bring down civilization? Well, there's me, and there's Ward... And there's me, and a ward, and it's like, what do you do? I mean, and this segues to something else that I mentioned to you in passing, but I do want to mention. I mentioned I was proud of my response to that woman at that one talk. I want to say what this was. I did a talk up in Vancouver, and I had done a talk there 6 months previously, and so they're not going to have me do the same endgame talk again. And so we go straight to Q&A. And unfortunately, I did not share the stage with you that night. That would have been delightful. It was just me. And the first question was, a woman stood up and said, I want to talk about hypocrisy in the environmental movement. And I'm thinking, oh, here we go. You know, she's going to say, you flew up here, which means I don't listen to anything you say. She did not go the direction I thought. Instead, she said, I was raped by someone you know. And the environmental community is a rape community, and I want to talk about that. And I said, okay, first, who? And she said his name, David Barbaresh. And he's an environmental and animal rights activist from BC. And I said, okay, first off, I don't actually know him. I interviewed him once. I don't know him. I got to tell you that. Not a friend of mine. Second, I believe you. Third, he was supposed to be in a book of interviews that I have coming out in a couple months, How Should I Live My Life? I'm taking him out of the book because I do not want a rapist in my book. And fourth, I would like to ask you what you as a woman in this culture want from a man when you tell him that you have been raped. What do you want from me as someone sitting here on stage? What do you want from your boyfriend? What do you want from your father? What do you want from your best friend? What do you want from fellow activists? And it was wonderful because so many women then talked about, this is what I want. This is what I got and this is what I did not get. And there were other women actually in the audience who had also been sexually assaulted by the same guy. Why did I bring all that up? Because sometimes I get pegged as the violence guy because I wanted to talk about fighting back, but I'm really the everything guy. And I really believe, I'm a writer for crying out loud, I believe in the importance of language and the importance of attempting to be precise and attempting to, words are sacred to me and words are living beings to me. And, but that doesn't take away from the other. That's all.
What you could maybe speak to better than me, because I have a criminal record, they're not going to put me in front of a class talking about biology, is you throw away the or throw out the word sustainable, a couple other, like, what are strictly ecological terms, in just in normal language that many of us are half familiar with, and there's a reluctance to accept sort of the basic truth of science, not the sort of shady, like, this is a theory kind of stuff, but the belief that our political, our intense political beliefs are somehow not subject to anything, because we can have any opinion we want, we can create our lives or whatever. And so I hear a talk that waves in and out of the deeply personal or the deeply political, and we throw in these environmental metaphors, and there's none of the weight of the fact that, like, you need so many calories and so many kilograms of water. There's none of the weight because we have had that eroded away. And I would, maybe you, maybe particularly you, could bring some of that back to people whose political convictions and personal convictions have been, I think, to their detriment, cut loose from the how much that matters.
Wait, you have just described the entire culture. You know, I mean, no, that's not a bad thing. I mean, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given. And the natural world, the real physical world, is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. It's insane, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Do you mind if I just keep going? Because I want to riff on this for a minute. If that's fine with you. I mean, I don't want to.
Go riff it.
Okay. Well, I want to be attentive to the fact that I'm a male and you're a female. I've been talking more than you have.
I know. You were advertised here more than I was. Maybe next time that won't be true.
Okay.
But this time.
Okay. So I was doing this radio interview in Santa Barbara, and I was talking about how 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and how salmon are getting hammered, and there's docks in every mother's breast milk, and you know, just all the things that I talk about all the time. And the radio interviewer kept saying the same thing, which is, that's all nice, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. And it's like, I thought I was talking about the real world. And then, but that's how a lot of people use it in everyday language, is what I realized is when he said real world, he meant industrial capitalism. And when college students a lot of times say the real world, how many people have ever said, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? You know, that means, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? What I'm going to do when I get out in the real world, I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real world. And John A. Livingston wrote this great book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. One of the things he talked about in there is how we evolved living in a real physical world. Imagine that. And how if you're put into an echo chamber, if you're put into a sensory deprivation chamber, you begin to hallucinate. And he says that cities are giant echo chambers because every sensory, how about input? How's that for a nice word? Every sensory perception that you have is mediated or created by human beings. It comes from one source. Right now, in this moment, what is anybody perceiving that was not created or mediated by human beings? And one of the questions I ask is, how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? How many wild animals do you have a daily relationship with? One of the reasons we don't defend the place that we live is because we don't live there. You know? We live. We know all these abstract things. We know all these distant things. But one of the things we have to do is to get back in the real world. And this is crucial for any number of reasons, one of which is that if your experience, not your head, not your heart, but your experience is that your food comes from a grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you'll defend to the death the system that brings those to you. And if your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you'll defend to the death those because your life depends on it. It's what you consider real. I was talking to my mom just this morning, and she was quoting that line back to me about how we will defend what is real. And she said, 25%, 50%. So like 50% of the people in the House of Representatives, et cetera, are millionaires. And they are defending what is real to them. And Hitler was defending what is real to him. The purity of the Aryan race. You know, it's all bullshit we can say. And it was bullshit. What is real to them is Wall Street. It's not even the economy, but it's Wall Street. There's a great line by this Brazilian general in the 1960s. Somebody asked him how the economy of Brazil was doing. He said, the economy is doing well, the people not so well. And so there's this absolute distance, you know? Salmon aren't real. Hammerhead sharks aren't real. None of that's real. That's still abstract. And so, even though he's gone, I want to take that back to what is real. And I've been talking a lot, so I'd like for you to talk for a while. Why don't you take the next question? Anybody have a question for her?
I have a question. You mentioned you don't pay taxes. I want to know how you do that, and any suggestions on how I don't have to do that.
Well, one way that you cannot do that is instead of, if you're working for someone else, like I do promotion for charities in the fall of every year at the federal government, kind of a thing. And so I have my own business, technically, and when you have your own business, you are required to pay taxes on your own quarterly. So if you choose not to pay them, you can choose not to do that. And in the United States, I got this information from the war tax resistance people. If you're in the United States, they generally won't take property. So I have a little trailer, and it's on common property with a whole other group of people, so they can't do anything with that. I don't have credit. I don't use banks. I do everything in cash. I don't own anything. I don't own anything that anyone could take away from me. I mean, I have this little trailer. It's worth $2,800. Okay. But that's it. That's all I have. Absolutely. And it's really horrible what the government will do, because I do some peace work, like, you know, Women for Peace kind of a stuff. We stand and do vigils and junk like that. And this one woman has been a nun all her life, and she's like, you know, 72 or whatever, and she went to Cuba with Witness for Peace. The federal government said she shouldn't go to Cuba with Witness for Peace. So they actually went in to her bank account to take money from her Social Security check. She's like this little old nun, you know, at 72, and they will go in your bank account, and they will take money from Social Security that they put in there. So I don't use banks or don't do any of that stuff. So it depends on what you're willing to risk. If you're willing to risk credit type stuff, like I don't have any credit because I don't use credit for anything. And if you're willing to risk those kinds of things, then you don't have to pay taxes. Or you can live below taxable income. But for me, I've just chosen to have my own company, technically, and just not pay the quarterly payments that I'm supposed to do. So that way my boss, who hires me a couple months a year, is able to turn in every year, what do they call those things, 990s, 940s, no, 990s is nonprofits. Something else, what is it?
1099.
So he can turn in the 1099 and say he paid me $15,000 this year, but he won't get in trouble because I'm technically responsible for sending in the stuff with them. And so I've been doing this for many, many years, and it works pretty well. Yeah.
I was told by someone who hasn't been paying taxes for a long time that if you don't make enough money, it's not worth it for them to go after you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but if you think that when they do the analysis of what they would gain, the cost of pursuing you, it's not worth it.
Yeah, I would hope that it would be that logical. That's not always the case, though. Sometimes, you know, you can be a small, very small fish, and just like with drug busts, the very small fish are the ones that get imprisoned, and the big people don't. And it's the same with Madoff and whatever, some of these people.
Yeah, if that were the case, then they would, if they were just doing simple economic analyses, they would go after the corporations, because that's where the money is. But so there's, and then add to that your political work, and that's going to add some extra possible flags.
It's possible, but you know, some friends of mine were down in Honduras, and they wanted me to get arrested with them there. And they decided not to use their passports because they said that's a privilege that they have so that they could get out. So they took them from Honduras and doing some action there, and they put them in a prison in Florida. And they were so difficult in the prison in Florida, organizing prisoners to do actions and stuff, that they actually just kicked them all out of prison. So there's just a lot of angles that you can get into once you really want to do this stuff. Any more questions? Yeah.
Can you tell us about where you live?
I live at a place called Earth Haven Eco Village. It's on the web. I don't use computers and I don't use the web, so I don't know what it looks like, but I've heard that it's on there. Huh?
It looks nice.
Does it? Okay. And it's 320 acres and there's about 60 people there. And it's interesting when I'm hearing people talk about these words, because in our community, we could take a year to discuss a word like agriculture. And so my opinion of that, of course, is if you were starving, we would know what agriculture was tomorrow. And it wouldn't be a year-long discussion. The only reason people can do these kind of discussions is because of our privilege. But that's,
which is true for discussions of violence, too.
Yeah. I mean, who is in the position where we can decide what we're going to talk about today? Should we talk about sustainable? The word sustainable means thousands of different things to different people, and all those people live in my community. You know, so it's really hard to get, people have really, one of the things about consensus and that kind of idea that we're all empowered and we can all say what we believe and stuff is that people come up with the most nitpicky, I mean, you can say what you believe and someone else can have the most nitpickiest difference. It can be like this big and they're going to have to say it. So you can spend a lot of time having discussions panties. You don't want to have. I hate that word.
Sorry. We'll still throw away a whole book over that word, which is crazy.
I didn't throw away the book.
I
just
told you.
I hate that word. But anyway, so it's an interesting community. It's kind of what we call eco-capitalism, which means everybody has to come up with their own bucks, and we buy into the community, and you can build kind of a house you want or whatever. So there's everything from 11-foot 3/4 inch by 11-foot 3/4 inch, which means you're just beneath 12-12. 12-12 is when they start deciding to call you a house. So if you have something that's 11 3/4 by 11 3/4, you're still in a shed. And so you don't have the same kind of stuff. And so we do a lot of experimenting there, which is why so many intentional communities are in places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, because the laws are very different and they allow for experimentation with composting toilets and gray water systems and stuff like that that are really hard to pull through in a place like Connecticut or Massachusetts or any of these northern states that are more codified, as it were. But it's an interesting experiment, and I haven't learned a whole lot there about living simply, because I came in knowing a lot about living simply. But in terms of trying to live with a group of people, when I got arrested last year, one of the things I had to say as I was walking through the group of protesters is it's so much easier to protest than it is to govern. Governing is hard. It takes a lot of maturity and cooperation and all kinds of stuff that, you know, people think, oh, I'm just going to go, we'll just be able to live, when everything collapses, we'll just be able to live together in community. And I'm thinking, there's more to it than that. There's a lot more to it. So in that way, those are the things that I'm really learning, is a lot of that inner, that kind of inner work there of listening to people more carefully, empathic, stuff like that. So
one of the things that my friend Jeanette Armstrong said to me, she's Okanagan Indian, she said, you know, we in our communities have just as many squabbles as, you know, you white people do, but the big difference is we know that my great-grandchild might marry your great-grandchild, and so we've had to come up with sustainable methods of conflict resolution and sustainable methods of, I mean, everybody ends up hating each other once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
And
definitely.
What are you going to do about that?
Yeah.
Can you tell us some about where you started to learn about and how you developed your knowledge about living simply? And or gained your knowledge. And also, if you have, can you talk about communication between intentional communities and whether or not that's
communication between intentional communities? Well, there's massive, as you know, an intentional communities network. There's an intentional communities book. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of intentional communities in the United States and Canada and Europe. We are part, our community is part of GEN, which is the Global Eco Village Network. And that's a global thing, and there's probably 20 eco villages on the planet right now or whatever, depending on how you determine and define yourself or whatever. I think that I just started out early liking camping and liking a lot of that stuff. I just liked that really early. But when I was in my late 20s, I moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Ann Arbor, Michigan is like this place, is like Ithaca, New York, is like Gainesville, Florida, is like Asheville, North Carolina. These are training towns. These are places where you can go and there's going to be food co-ops, there's going to be holistic healing, there's going to be recycling, there's going to be all those alternative methodologies in place already. So if you go there with an open mind and a participatory framework like I did, then you can really learn a lot really fast. And so I went to Ann Arbor and it was just like that. I mean, there was just hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people that were participating. We had a food co-op and we had a bakery and we had, I mean, it was just all right in a row. So you could really learn things quickly. And so I find voluntary simplicity to be fun. In a culture where everybody wants to make money, it's just fun, this ostentatious underconsumption, to just mess with people's minds. It's just an adventure. I mean, it's just an adventurous thing, you know. Oh, so I lose my watch band or whatever. This is elastic. I just sew a piece of elastic on it. Okay, so anybody can just go, oh, that's awful, that's elastic. I think it's cool. Cut my own hair. I've always cut my own hair. I mean, I just think it's cool. You think it's funky? I'm saving money. This is following my guidelines for what I want to do with my life and my resources. I don't know another word I should use. But so it's like, it's this game thing. You know, it's like I tell people that come to Earth Haven that are my age, I say, your kids are grown. Once your kids are grown and gone, you can do whatever you want. Okay? Because your kids are like, we need a car, Mom. We want to be in a regular house like regular people. You know, okay, whatever. But when you get old, you can go build a tree house. You can play. You can do, you don't have to live in 3-4 bedrooms. You don't have to do that. You can let go of that if you choose. And you can use your time and energy and money. If you got a big house, hey, 10 people living in it, I can see that. But don't be 2 people in there. I have problems. So it's just kind of how do you see this living thing as an adventure? How do you stay where a lot of you all are coming from now without going into the big, heavy adult reality? Because so many people that are in college, as you know, they're writing stuff down for their resume. They're living in a co-op house in college, and then they're writing on a resume. Or they're vegetarian. Oh, that can go down a resume, too. I've never filled out a resume, so I'm in a different position for sure. Yeah.
Just to add on what you just said, I'm having like a hard time coping of like why I'm here. As to like, I feel as though it's so formulaic, high school, college, resumes. Like I'm at my prime. I could be doing a lot of stuff that I love. I'm like miserable trying to stress over implicit different. Whatever. Like, I have an exam next week, and like, to put it into perspective, what the hell is gonna, like, what impact does this have on my life? Why can't I just be enjoying life for what it is? I see you. I mean, like, I would aspire to be like you. I think you live a great life. Like, in relevance, the importance of being here, I'm like struggling to find worth in it, and I don't know, any advice as to whether this is really, in reality, preparing me for a life that I would want to be worth living, or if I should invest my time in other things?
Well, the question always is, and we talked about this before, right, sacred task, didn't we mention this earlier? We mentioned the idea of a sacred task. Okay, if you have the idea of a sacred task is, that is like, what is it in your heart and in your being that says you are going to contribute? You want to contribute. Because I'd be willing, is there anybody here that does not want to contribute to a life of easier living for everybody, everything, whatever, a simpler way of living without all this complexity? Is anybody doesn't want to live that way? Is there anybody that really just wants to have a lot of money and say, fuck everybody else? Yeah. Let me see those hands. Let me see him. Seriously, people want to contribute. People want to be part of a community. People want to be able to give of themselves. People want to be able to use their intelligence and creativity. I believe that. And I think money is like this really secondary, awful thing that they got to keep putting up in front of you to say, see, this is what you really want, right? This is what you really want. A flat screen, right? This is what you really want. It's kind of like the way they do it with the word God. And they have to keep saying he, because everywhere you look, the female of the species is given birth. It ain't no he. So they got to keep saying that to keep you in that illusion about this, about patriarchy and all that kind of stuff. So if you can look at what it is that you really have to contribute and go into your heart about that, then you can decide if you're going to spend this money or your parents are going to spend this money or if you're going to have this loan for who knows how long or if you can, you're really learning something that's going to allow you to serve. There's a book that I just read, which I thought was pretty good, and it's four teenagers, actually, but I just read it, so that shows you why. And it's called The Teenage Liberation Handbook, and it's a de-schooling handbook, and it's for teenagers, but it's about looking at what school really does, what's the purpose of school, what should you be in school, what you might be able to do not in school, what some other kids who have chosen not to do that school scene, what they've chosen to do. And I thought it was just a really good book. I read it about 6 months ago, and I just felt it was really useful. I mean, you didn't have to get like pregnant like I did and kicked out of high school. I mean, that's not the easy way to do it. There's easier ways to do this than that. So, go ahead.
What year are you in school?
This is my first semester, and I find like no motivation to be here. It sucks.
Okay, so I'm gonna answer a little bit differently than if you were a junior or senior.
Sorry?
I'm gonna answer a little bit differently than if you were a junior or senior. One of the smartest things that my mom said to me was when I was a junior in college. She said, would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have a degree in physics, or would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years for a degree in physics? And that sentence really convinced me to stay one more year. And that was really helpful because through my 20s, I think the most I probably ever made in a year was probably $3,000 or $4,000, and that was exceptional. Usually what I did was called deficit spending or, you know, voluntary simplicity, really. And cadging. But I had a safety net because at any moment I could have quit and got a job at 35K working in physics back in the 80s. And had I quit when I was a junior, my backup plan, my safety net would have been, would you like fries with that? And I never did get a job that way, but for me, and I'm not saying for you or for anybody else, but for me it was really important to have, I can be extremely courageous as long as I know my back's covered. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you didn't have that safety net, it doesn't sound like. Mm-mm. I had a big safety net that at any moment I could have picked up the phone and called up a headhunter and said, hey, I would like to go to work for Lawrence Livermore Labs and sell my soul, and could I please speak to the devil? And being able to do that gave me the courage to. I was poor enough at some points. I was collecting cans to buy enough to get enough that I could buy peanut butter. You know, and am I going to buy? I'm sure you've been there. It's like, am I going to buy an orange or an apple? I was on food stamps for about 3 months, and it was so cool to actually go into the grocery store and get both an apple and an orange. Can you believe how great this is? I still have not made as much as I would have started at in 1983. But I am so happy because I am rich enough now. I know a restaurant's a bad thing, but if I go to a restaurant, I can get an appetizer. You know, this is that was about 5 years ago. I can go to a dentist. I finally got my teeth cleaned. How cool is that? I know, I mean, there's a certain level of voluntary simplicity. I mean, I live pretty simply myself, and that's great. And then there are times when it can also, it's like, how am I going to go to the dentist? You know, I have incurable progressive disease, and I now have insurance, but a couple years ago, I had $15,000, 4 years ago, I had $15,000 worth of hospital bills. What do you do with $15,000 worth of hospital bills when you make $25,000? It's a really bad place to be. And at the time, I was making $18,000. So my point is that I was able to be so courageous because I couldn't do it now because I don't even remember differential equations at this point. But, you know, for a long time, I could have gone another direction. And I still have a backup plan. I could always teach at a university if I had to. So I still have a backup plan, which allows me to be this courageous. But since you're a first year, I don't know what the hell to tell you. That makes it much more difficult because one thing to say, okay, put up with one more year. You know, and then when I graduated, I told my mom I didn't want to stay in physics, and she said, "Great, don't stay in it." And I said, well, wait, I just wasted 4 years. And she said, well, it's better than wasting your life. So my mom was like, she was very wise in terms of, yeah, hang in there for one more year, and then you'll have this safety net. But I don't know what she would say. Actually, you should call my mom. That's what elders are for.
That's what elders are for.
Because I didn't know. I was so unhappy. And what did I do? I went to my mom. And my mom didn't say, oh, you know. I mean, she was great. And I don't know what to tell you about that, except, you know, talk to your mom or somebody else's mom. I mean, if you're... Talk to her.
I teach here, and I tell my students, if you are bored in class, say something. I mean, the amount of boredom that is on this campus is mind-boggling. So you are the paying customers. If you are not motivated, if you're not excited, if you're not learning, stand up and say, I'm so sick of PowerPoint. Learn how to teach. Go back to school. Get the hell out of the class. In the spring, and I think we might read The Teenager's Guide to that sounds like a good book.
What's your name?
Phoebe Godfrey.
I'd like to take that a step further. My advice to you would be a little bit different. You know, this whole thing about words that we have is sort of a metaphor for what's actually kind of happening for you. What I see is not so much what word we use, but how other people's perception, other people's words change our perception of ourselves. So what I would say is, you know, rather than look at what's been going on or what system you're in or whatever, you really need to perceive what, you know, what's real for you. And, I mean, I'd take some time off, man, figure that out before I would go through more school. School is the biggest way that we have to indoctrinate everyone into all these words that you're all talking about, all these ideas that are corrupting us and how we're destroying our planet. And I mean, school is horrible. And, you know, I'm glad to see that there are a lot of students here, but I mean, we really do need to change the way that we perceive ourselves. And, you know, it's one thing to use a word in a particular way, but to allow others to use that word to help us define ourselves, which is what I think is kind of happening to you, is really not a good thing.
Well, people in here know I wrote a book on education, right? It's called self-promotion here. The first two sentences are two of my best first sentences of any book, and they are, as is true for most people I know, I've always loved learning. As it's also true for most people I know, I always hated school. Why is that? I mean, school accomplishes an extraordinary thing, which is to make people not like learning.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really extraordinary accomplishment.
You know, who is it, Hume or Locke or one of them said that education is not the filling of a pail, it's the lighting of a fire. And I have no idea why that fire was lit in me, Catholic schools, whatever. I don't know. But I have loved to learn all my life. But I'll tell you this, every September, I think to myself, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to go to school. I'm 64 and I'm still saying, I'm so glad I don't have to go to school. But I love to learn, you know. And so it's like this whole different dynamic, and once you can maybe take yourself more out of the expectation of a particular career, making a certain amount of money with a certain kind of expectations, with the 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week, with sitting in front of a damn computer 8 hours a day, whatever, once you can take your talent outside of that and look and say, what do I really need? What do I really need to survive? How big of a space do I need? How can I get along with other people? How might I be able to not spend so much money? How can I, you know, resale shops, hello, every bit, everybody knows. We got a free store at our community, so I also get stuff at this free store. But that whole dynamic, I think, is a really useful thing to examine at this point in time so that you can make those decisions. Yeah.
Just a sec. I wanted to say something about
that.
Which is that I went to school after high school 3 times, and I hated 2 of them. The first one was because I got a scholarship, and because if you go to calculus in high school, then you're supposed to go to engineering school. And I actually tried to transfer out of the Colorado School of Mines to the University of Colorado to take writing, and I went into the registrar's office, and the registrar said, wait a second, you have a scholarship to the School of Mines and you want to transfer to the University of Colorado in English? Are you out of your mind? I was like, well, okay. And then I went back to School of Mines. And then the second time, then I went to graduate school for 1 year because I had a year of eligibility left for high jumping. And this is a terrible reason to go to school, too. And that was just miserable. But then I went back when I was 29 or 28 or something. I went back and I got an MFA in creative writing. And the reason I went to school then is because I had learned as much as I could from dead writers. And I wanted to learn how to write better, and I wanted to have a teacher who could talk back, as opposed to, I can't ask Dostoevsky questions, you know? I can, but I'm not always sure of the answers. And, of course, that's true from reading his books, too. And I loved it. And part of the reason I loved it is because I took absolute control of my own education. I said, you know what? You don't offer a playwriting minor? I want a playwriting minor. So how do we make this happen? And I never would have had the confidence to do that in college, the first time. And besides which, I hated science anyway, so... And the only good thing I got out of my degree in science is now I'm a strong critic of science. I think science is bullshit. And then I'll say science is bullshit, and people will say, oh my God, that's blasphemy. I'm like, oh yeah, I have a bachelor's in science, bachelor's in mineral engineering physics from Colorado School of Mines, and your degree's in communications? So let's talk about science for a while. So it gives me some credibility, you know? So yeah, just I want to echo what they both said about taking charge. But there's also the fact that you're then, what, 19? 18? And... So I have a couple questions, and these are rhetorical. I don't expect you to have answers right now. I would not have had these answers. I would have hated my books if I read them at 18. I voted for Ronald Reagan when I was 19, for crying out loud. And
I voted for Nixon.
If I had read my books in high school, I would have hated them. In college, they would have troubled me, and I wouldn't have understood them. By the time I was a senior in college, I would have needed them. And by the time I was 24, 25, I would have been hungry for them. So, you know, my point is that we evolve. But I'm going to ask these questions just to plant them. First one is, what are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? That may change over time. You know, and I wouldn't have been able to say, you know, when I was 18, I would not have been able to say what they are. But now I can say what they are. There's a huge hole in our discourse. There's a hole in discourse. There are 2 million dams in the United States, 70,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. If we only took out one of those dams every day, it would take 200 years to take out those dams. Salmon don't have that time and sturgeon don't have that time. I looked around, I saw a big hole in our discourse. I didn't see any environmentalists talking about fighting back. I didn't see anybody talking about how this culture is psychopathological. I didn't see very many people, I didn't see any men making the connections between rape and environmental degradation. Women, I didn't see any men doing it. Okay, there's my job. I got my task laid out for me. And I couldn't have done that at 18. And the other thing is, and also this would have changed over time, is what do you get off on? What do you get off on doing? I mean, one of the reasons I've written so many books is because I get off on doing what I do. And that's different than what do you love. You know, I love the salmon. I know that's really deep and meaningful and everything. It's like, what do you get off on? It's much more just, what do you get off on doing? And it's like I was hanging out with this wetland specialist. I love this story. Hanging out with this wetland specialist. We were working together to stop a subdivision. Development's another word I don't like. Working together to stop a subdivision and to stop the murder of some trees. And he was digging in the dirt, and they'd rub his fingers between the soil between his fingers, and they would compare the color of the soil to a chart, and that would help him determine whether these are wetland soils. And I looked at him and I said, "Do you get off on doing this?" He said, "Oh yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs." And I said, "Well, that's great, because this would be hell for me." On the other hand, I've condemned myself to a life of homework, you know? I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. I mean, I get so excited by, like, that stuff that I wrote, that I read. You know, that was the best part of the whole airplane trip, which, you know, frankly, it was an airplane trip. It's not very fun anyway. But, you know, it's just, I get off on trying to figure out how it is, this is the book I'm working on right now, how it is that if indigenous peoples have had really intense and good relationships with beings on other sides, how is it that the dominant culture has always been able to kill them? And how is it that if the earth really is intelligent, which I fully believe, if the earth is sentient, why hasn't it killed us off? Mm-hmm. It's like, goddamn, why did smallpox go the wrong direction? You know, October 12th is Columbus Day, and...
Invaders Day.
Yeah, exactly. and the day of mourning.
Yes, exactly.
And did you know that there was a mutiny on Columbus's ship? Do you know this? A mutiny on Columbus's ship on October 11th. And they said, we're going back. And he said, give me one more day. I mean, why that day? And it was moonlight. You know, they saw moonlight shining off the beach. Why wasn't it cloudy that night? Tell me that. Why wasn't it cloudy? Or there were so many attempts made to kill Hitler. So many attempts. It's like a Monty Python movie where he's walking around and there's just like, you know, swords falling behind him. He doesn't see him. There was an attempt on Hitler's life made that failed because a fly landed on somebody's hand. For real. I'm not making that up. Because a fly landed on somebody's hand, the attempt failed. There were times where they put bombs in a plane of Hitler's. And he took off and they were altitude dependent to go off. And the timers went off. I'm not the timers. The what's it called? The explosives. The detonators. The detonators went off. Didn't set off the explosives. Another time, Hitler was in Russia, and some tanks were able to break through the German lines. And they got up to the airport where Hitler was going to take off. They ran out of gas at the edge of the airport. It's like something's going on here, you know. And so that's the book I'm doing right now. I totally get off on trying to figure out. Okay, so I'm going to give some of my answers real quick. One of the answers, maybe science is right, and the world really is dead. And just humans are the only intelligence in the entire universe. Everything else is just dead matter. And so when the Indians were praying, they were just praying to nobody, you know? And when I say, why hasn't the earth fought back? That's like asking why the toolbox doesn't, you know, bite you when you try to reach in for a wrench, you know? Maybe science is right. I don't think so, but maybe. That's one possibility. Maybe the Christians are right. You know, maybe there's only one God, and maybe he's just one nasty mother. You know? He's like, the Christian God, he's a really bad piece of work, you know? And besides, he's really weird. Okay, first off, he's omniscient, he's omnipotent, he's the only God, and he's jealous? It's like...
And there's a devil.
Get some counseling, dude. You know? But the point is, I get off on trying to figure that out. So, I am going to give you some advice, which is... whether you stay in school or not, I actually don't care. I don't think that's the important question. I can say that because I'm not in school. My advice to you would be, whether you stay in school or not, that you spend the next 5 or 6 years figuring out what you love enough that you would live your life for it, and what you love enough that you would die for it, and what you love enough that you would that you will spend your life in service to. What do you love enough? And what is there that you feel so strongly about? You know, and frankly, when I was 18, 19, what I felt strongly enough about was high jumping. And that's okay, you know? But for then, I lived my life. That's what got me through college, was I loved high jumping so much. And so what is there that you love? Because it's your life. It's not my life. It's not your life. It's not your life. It's not your life. It's not your parents' life. It's not your counselor's life. It's not your teacher's life. It's your life. You're the one who's got to live with it, and you got to live with the results. So what do you love? First. Second. What do you get off on? And third, what are your gifts? And so my advice to you, in fact, my directive to you, is to, no matter what you do, figure those out. That is your job right now. One more thing. It can change. It can change.
It will change.
It will change. I used to think that it should be a law that nobody should get married at 20. It's like, if you get married at 20, you deserve what happens to you. Because I dated one woman all through my 20s, and we were long distance for about 2 years in the middle. And then when we got back together, she said to me one time as we were breaking up, she said, you know, I used to think that I knew you better than you knew yourself, and now I don't even know who you are. And I remember what I thought in that moment was, I'm really glad because I didn't like who I was when I was 20. And so I'm glad that you don't know who I am anymore, because I'm not the same person I was that when we were together before. And we changed so much.
When you were talking about different housing cooperative places to live, like North Carolina and all the different places, Gainesville, and you're talking a lot about like what you're willing to do and how you're willing to live, I guess I'm just wondering what your thoughts are if you bring like a class analysis into that, because I don't think a lot of people have choice. Can't really like will yourself into like go living on a co-op if you're, you know, living in poverty with a bunch of kids or something. So I guess... to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like if I take what you're saying and follow that path, unless you can, like, mix it up a little, it seems like you're saying, like, what we need to do, what's wrong with our society is, you know, have some sort of exodus from capitalism. Like, just leave it. Have alternative institutions and go do that, and it'll go away. And we can all do that if we want to badly enough. And, like, for me, I think we need to confront capitalism in the state, and we need to fight it. I don't think everyone has the privilege to make the choices you've made, for instance, or the choices I've made. So I'm just wondering, so I'm not assuming that what you're saying, if you can maybe speak to that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I come from, I guess, the middle class, although neither of my parents went to college, and I was told at my community by someone that I could not be middle class if neither one of my parents went to college. That was their definition of middle class. So my idea about cooperative living, okay, and it is opposed at a certain place to capitalism, because what we're attempting to do is live a more non-exploitive life, and that's part of the way I define capitalism, as something that is an exploitation-based lifestyle. So for me, a cooperative lifestyle is different than a capitalist lifestyle. And I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I think that you can live a simple cooperative lifestyle and still work against capitalism and challenge capitalism and get arrested at the World Bank and whatever. I think all that can happen simultaneously. The advantage of practicing a different economic format or a different way of looking at things or a different way of sharing things, this idea of access without ownership. What does that mean? But the more that we practice those things, the more real it is, and the more we learn the details. That's why if I come and talk to people about living in a community that's off the grid, there's a lot of details in living in a community off the grid that just saying, well, you should just get solar panels and use insulated shades. The details are there if you've lived that way. So if you choose to be vegetarian, which I've been vegetarian for 32 years, if you choose that, I know a lot of details about different aspects of vegetarian living from the raw blah, blah, blah over here to all these other aspects that were done, to fasting, to whatever. So as you practice those things, you begin to get insight into what can work, what can't work, what you can change. I just think it gives you a better outlook on things because you're just more knowledgeable.
Well, I completely agree with you that if we need other institutions to move into, we can't just leave these and have nowhere to go. If we're going to get rid of capitalism, of course, we need to figure out how we're going to live, how we're going to organize ourselves differently. We're not just going to not organize ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I guess my question to you is, obviously, creating and building and experimenting with alternative institutions to be living in, how do we get rid of this one that's oppressing so many people? Because that's going to help you, and that's going to help those however many people live on the place where you live, where your shed is, and their sheds. That's going to help all of them. But what about all of us? We need to liberate all of us. How do you see that?
I don't see us liberating all of us immediately. That may need to happen as push comes to shove and everything goes, and all the electricity goes off, which means all the computers goes off, which means all the gasoline can't be pumped, which means I don't know that everybody really knows how much of our lives is run on electricity. I live someplace where we're off the grid, so when all these rolling blackouts and stuff happen everywhere, it doesn't happen in our community. And so it's if we're thinking in terms of down the line, our putting an example, for instance, out in our little community, which can be done in urban areas, and urban areas are doing these transition towns, and there's just so much going on. The whole Simple Living Network, which I've never seen, but which I hear is really good, is an introduction into all this stuff. And like I said, you don't stop living, you don't stop everything at once. I work for social justice. I hire women that work in a transitional shelter or live there. I try to do a lot of things at once. And having a place like we have where people come and visit, they do tours, they get inspired. We have college classes coming through. We have high school classes coming through. People volunteer and they learn to make houses and stuff. This is an educational format. It's not done like this because we're not that plugged in, but you don't have to do an either or thing. That's always.
I'm not saying that at all. I think what you're saying is very important, but I think that I was just wondering how you see the rest of the struggle. Obviously, what you're doing is part of the struggle. I'm just trying to understand
the rest of the struggle. You mean the stuff that other people are doing?
No. Yeah, I guess maybe that's one way to look at it. I'm doing this part, and other people are doing another part. I'm wondering how you advocate for revolution. I guess.
Well, one way I advocate for revolution is through ostentatious underconsumption, is to just get people thinking about how we participate every day in supporting the dominant system, because it's through all of our support that everything continues to go on. So for me, the first thing to do is I'm an underminer. One of the things I really loved is I was reading about these anti-nuclear people in Germany, and they were really against the transportation of, you know, of nuclear waste. And instead of trying to overthrow something, they dug a tunnel under the highway. So the highway collapsed, so they couldn't run the nuclear waste back and forth. That's much more my tactic. Undermining is much more my tactic than this overthrowing thing. I'm not interested in that. How do I withdraw my support? How do I withdraw my tax dollars? How do I withdraw my energy? How do I help create a whole different energy field in looking at the way that we might be able to live together and be politically active and support people that are doing stuff that it's more direct action stuff? Well, I mean, I think there's a wide variety of ways that people can attempt that, but for me, my lifestyle is first, because that gives me access to, even if I just pay attention to the way indigenous people live, and have a lot of potlucks and potlatches and share the wealth and give a bunch of stuff away like they did. That's a different way of looking at how we can interface with the rest of the world, I think.
I actually want to respond to this too.
I can see your mouth is open.
Yeah. And that's a really, really rich and important question on a bunch of levels. I want to answer a bunch of those levels, or insofar as I can. One of them is, I was sharing the stage with Karen Raffensperger, who's a good friend of mine, who's also a pacifist. And at one point, it was similar to this. And at one point, she was describing what a sustainable community would look like, and would smell like, and would feel like, and democratic decision-making processes. And the whole time, I'm doing the same thing I was doing here, which is... And finally, she turns to me and she says, "So it's very clear you want to say something, Derek." I said, "Yeah, this is all great. You're describing what it's going to look like. But right now, those in power are psychopaths. And if we have this democratic community that you're talking about, and there are resources on that land that those in power want, they will take them. They will kill you and they will take them. So how do we get there from here?" And she smiled at me very sweetly and said, "That's your job to describe, Derek. I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. And one reason I don't, or the place I was where I learned it, was when I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax. And I recognized every day that I walked in there, I was participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And at the same time, a lot of my students were telling me that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes. And so how do I join with that? At that moment, the revolution versus reform dichotomy fell apart for me. Because if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, which I am working every moment of my life for, that is what my life is about. Everything is about the pre-revolutionary phase. I mentioned the Battle of Algiers. Everything in my life, I am a recruiter for the revolution. I want to bring this thing down. I want to do it using any means necessary. Everything is about organizing for that. And we need to have organized resistance. We need to bring down this whole system. And at the same time, the fighters need to eat. And I'm going to look over at you. Because, you know, you can't... Once again, we need all that. And so... that's another thing. The class analysis is another thing that I wrote down here on the plane was who will do it? Because I was doing a talk in Portland about a month ago, and this one woman said, "You know, I want for the dams to come out, but I'm scared of state repression, and I don't want to do it. And who's going to do it?" And my answer to her was, one thing we need to not do is we need to make sure that we don't put the indigenous on the front line yet again. And we need to not put the poor on the front line yet again. What I wrote on the plane was, who will do it? The middle class have the luxury to do this. It's not the job of the poor or the otherwise oppressed. They're too busy staying simply alive. It is our job. There was a guy came up to me years and years ago after I wrote The Culture of Make-Believe. And he said, he was a black guy, he was really mad at me. He said, "You know, You were able to write and publish this book because you're white." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, they wouldn't have published this if I wrote it." And I said, "No, they probably wouldn't." He said, "Well, you're white and you wrote it." I said, "Yeah, I did. And that's why. Because if you are a member of an oppressor class, it is not the responsibility of any members of the oppressed classes to differentiate you from others of the oppressors."
That's right.
It is not your job as a woman to differentiate me from other men. It is my job as a male to differentiate myself. And where I realized this was talking to Darja Mail. I was thinking about going to, I was just sort of putting myself in his place. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Iraq and I'm going to say, "Hey, I don't like the American invasion. I want to help you. You know, it's like it wouldn't be their fault if they shoot me the first day there because I'm an American. And it is my responsibility to differentiate myself. That's true on a class level. And this is one of the reasons why universities get shut down in Latin America, used to get shut down in Latin American countries, is because that's where a lot of action happens, is where you have people who have the luxury, as I do, to learn how to read. On a global level, everyone in this room is extraordinarily wealthy because we have been taught how to read and write. And that makes us extraordinarily wealthy. And it is our responsibility to use that privilege to undercut its basis. And so what happens is, a lot of times, the universities become hotbeds of revolution because you would get the people who had the luxury to do the theorizing would come together with those who lived directly under the iron boot of oppression. And that's where the magic occurs. I interviewed a member of the MRTA, the Tupac Amaristas, years ago, in the 1990s. That's the Japanese group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house. I mean, the Peruvian group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house. I interviewed him, and I said, one of the things he said to me was, you've been privileged enough to learn how to write. Most of the people in the MRTA are not that rich. And so you need to use that. And he said also, by the way, there have been a lot of people who have picked up both the gun and the pen. I want to say one more thing about this, too, which I think might be the most important thing I say tonight, which if you're going to write anything down, write this down, which is the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority. I'm sorry. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. Because I want to read this, because it really applies to this. A few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers will be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope is a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground even to the end, even to the death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we'll be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps most important of all, what are you willing to do?
You've been listening to A Dialogue with Derek Jensen, Red Moon Song, and students from the University of Connecticut at Storrs, recorded last month. Thanks to the UConn Free Press and John Schwenk for making this available. The unexpurgated 3-hour version is available online for free download and will be linked to the page of this episode at the Unwelcome Guests Archive at unwelcomeguests.org. The reason I'm able to provide an Unwelcome Guest website and show archive and podcast to you is because of the AINFOS Radio Project at radioforall.net. If you wish to be able to continue to receive the show online, then please support the project at radioforall.net. Radio for All is run by a volunteer collective, but our bandwidth provider wants to be paid. We need to raise $5,000, our yearly budget. Any donation, no matter how small, is urgently needed. Thank you for listening.